Good morning, everyone. Has Mr. Fink appeared?
Not yet.
We're going to pass the first case for a moment and proceed to case number two on the docket today, which is United States versus Joseph Gibson, appeal number 07-2330. Mr. O'Connor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Timothy O'Connor. I am one of the attorneys for the appellant, Joseph Gibson. Your Honors, this case arose from what the government contends was a murder-for-hire plot. According to the government, Mr. Gibson ran a drug spot, or drug-dealing area, on the west side of Chicago. And he had done so previously in partnership with a man named Jeffrey Coleman. Mr. Coleman went to jail, and when he came out, according to the government, he was angry at Mr. Gibson. And the government contends that Mr. Gibson then reached out to a third man named Walter Hampton and tried to convince Mr. Hampton to kill Mr. Coleman And unbeknownst to Mr. Gibson, Mr. Hampton was a government informant. An investigation was undertaken. Conversations and meetings were recorded, and Mr. Gibson was indicted with two counts of violating the federal murder for hire statute, 18 United States Code, section 1958, one count of being a felon in possession of a firearm, and one count of knowingly possessing a firearm with an obliterated serial number. He proceeded.
You contend that the evidence was not sufficient to show that Gibson wanted this guy killed?
Well, I don't concede the point, but I am not appealing the intent that part of the intent issue on appeal.
Only the hire, whether he was hiring Hampton to do it.
Whether there was the requisite, as we would say, agreement or consideration, and whether he had that intent that the murder be committed that way. But I want to make clear I'm not conceding the point. We did contest it below.
But it's your sort of characterization of this offer that really the heart of the case is. And I guess my question is it your position that when someone offers to pay a hitman a percentage of his future profits in exchange for commission of a murder, he is not offered consideration in exchange for an act of murder?
Well, my answer to that, Judge Williams, is that if you could show a firm promise of that nature, I think you would have something that would come within the statute. But on these facts, with this particular promise, I would say no. And the reason I say that, just to take a step back, is this is a case where, and I think this is, if I may, in the course of answering your question, I think I can also distill the essence of what much of what we think was wrong here, not all of it, but much of it, to this point. The government began the case with the argument that Mr. Gibson had offered half the proceeds of the drug spot to have Mr. Hampton to have Mr. Coleman killed. 4 days later, that alleged promise lay in tatters after 4 days of trial. And the government's response, the best way I can characterize it, is an analogy to football. They went then with what I'll call a spread offense. At the end of the trial, they're offering about a half dozen different agreements.
Yeah, then they went to a couple hundred dollars. But so what? If something was offered, and that's the critical issue here, and I think your argument, as I read it, is that you need almost a Williston on contracts type of contract here, offer concept, acceptance, consideration, all that sort of stuff. When this is sometimes done with a wink and a nod, and if the evidence is sufficient to show that something of value was carroted out there for Hampton, and he was ready to act on that, why isn't that sufficient?
Well, because that didn't happen here. And because not all promises or alleged promises come within this statute. The problem here is that when Congress wrote this law, Congress used a very deliberate, very limiting choice of words. They said in consideration for receipt, or in consideration for a promise or agreement to pay anything of pecuniary value. And that dramatically constricted the scope of this statute. And the jury instructions here...
Well, let me just stop you for a minute. So how are we to take, then, Gibson's confession that he had given the gun to Hampton to kill Coleman, and though he was going to pay Hampton, he had not decided how much he was going to pay? So he admitted he was going to pay it. I mean, in addition to the evidence Judge Evans outlined.
Well, my answer to that, Judge Williams, would be twofold. Number one, looking just at that alleged statement alone, if you were to credit that, I would say that's still not enough because it's not a promise or agreement to pay anything. It's not consideration, and that's the word that Congress chose here. Judge Flom in the Richardson case said you had to find a bargain for exchange with an exchange of promises. That's what he did. I haven't decided how much to pay you is nothing of that sort.
But it's coupled with other evidence. I know you want to parse it and say that's perhaps the only thing, but there's more because then you have the Hampton statement.
But I just want to say this. In addition, the problem here is stepping back from that and going back to the problem created by the spread offense, which are all the different agreements that the government offered here. The district court's instructions didn't reflect anything like the limitations in this statute and the tools the jury needed to sort through these various different promises and determine whether they came within the statute or whether they did not, and also to come to unanimity if they felt that there was one that was appropriate and they agreed that it happened. And what I'm trying to say here is that even if you were to say, Judge Williams, that I haven't decided how much to pay was enough, we can't say with any confidence that the jury convicted on that basis. The United States government here argued to this jury, and this I'll just take the first instruction, one of the instructions we wanted. We wanted an instruction that said, incidental expenses of a murder don't count. They're not consideration. We had two federal appellate court cases that said precisely that. And we had all these other cases that say it's got to be a bargain for exchange. A number of cases say you have to have an agreement. The case that's most adverse to us, Hernandez, even uses the phrase in exchange for. But under any reading of the law, incidental expenses don't constitute consideration. The government said in the final vignette between Hampton and Gibson that Gibson had promised to pay a couple of $100 for Hampton to get out of town. When you look at the government's own transcript of that conversation, I don't know how anyone could have believed that. And that's one of our arguments. No rational jury could have. Gibson says, what do you have to get out of town for? And Hampton says, well, I'm worried about you. And Gibson says, don't worry about me. I'm cool. The government tried to argue, well, he agreed because in this long statement Hampton made with a lot of things in it, Gibson punctuates it with the word right. But I just want to come to this one point. We say we were entitled to an instruction telling the jury, even if you believe that Gibson said, well, here's a couple $100 to get out of town after the murder, we were entitled to an instruction that would have let us tell the jury that's not consideration, that's incidental expenses. And there's no better authority for the fact that that's incidental expenses than Walter Hampton. Page 425 of the transcript. Page 425. This is the cross-examination of Walter Hampton. Now, was the couple of hundred dollars you're talking about, whether or not you were going to leave town, was that your compensation for committing the murder? Answer, no, sir. Question, because your compensation was supposed to be something about splitting the profits on this drug spot, is that correct? Answer, yes, sir. Question, that we've already talked about? Answer, yes, sir. Question, so the $100, according to your testimony, would be expense money, correct? Answer, yes, sir. The minute he gave that testimony, page 425 of the transcript, page 425, the minute Hampton said that, we were entitled to a jury instruction that said incidental expenses don't count. We didn't get it. And the jury instructions here use the phrase in consideration for, not as a limitation. To the layperson's ear, it came off sounding like in relation to. And the government took full advantage of that. I quote from their closing argument. So you have not only the fifth, this is in our reply brief, so you have not only the 50% share of the drug proceeds from the Pulaski and Adams spot, but the money that the defendant was going to give Walter Hampton to get out of town. He's got to lay low, and he needs some money to do it in consideration for his participation in the murder. The government expressly argued to the jury that money that Hampton himself said was not compensation, was not consideration, it was expense money, expressly told the jury that was consideration. And my point here is that fact alone interjects into this record a ground the jury could have held against Gibson on that is legally invalid and warrants reversal. Because you, even if you were to believe or look at, Judge Williams, the statement you raised, we can't say with any confidence that that's the basis upon which the jury convicted Mr. Gibson, and it's hardly overwhelming evidence. I would say it's legally insufficient. The first instruction I was talking about there was our one on incidental expenses. The second one I wanted to come to was we argued that basically the district court should have instructed the jury that there had to be an agreement or a contract here. And I think the law and the statute and the legislative history absolutely made that clear. Let me turn to this court's decision in United States versus Richeson. Judge Flom there expressly used the phrase bargained for exchange. There has to be a bargain for exchange. And he went and he found that looking through these tapes. And if you take a step back and you interject that analysis on an exchange that's about something that's legal. So instead of, in that case, commit the murder and I'll let you keep the gun, suppose I'm saying to the kid next door to me, if you'll rake my lawn, I'll let you keep the rake. And boy, I'll even give you a chance to work with my lawn care business. That would be an oral contract, right? If the child didn't show up to rake, I suppose I could sue. And if I didn't hand over the rake or let the child work with the lawn care business, I think the child could sue. But there was no reflection in these instructions of that concept in consideration for read as something like in relation to. That's what was said to this lay jury. But beyond Richeson, I would look at take the case that's most difficult for us, Hernandez, the one where the court says, well, look, we don't like the idea of contract-based rules here. This is really immoral. The court goes on to say it has to be in exchange for, which is not a concept that was reflected in these instructions. The government was able to argue that the $200 to get out of town that Mr. Hampton said was not payment for the murder was consideration precisely because the limitation in exchange for wasn't even there. But I want to point out about the Hernandez court. They reached their analysis that in consideration for means in exchange for by using a Random House dictionary off the shelf.
If let's suppose you were had a situation where somebody talked to a hitman and said, you take care of my wife and I'll make it worth your while. Would that violate the statute?
No.
I mean, I can agree that that would not be a contract because the terms would not be sufficiently concrete to enforce that in a court of law, but why wouldn't that be enough? You're promising some type of reward if somebody does your bidding.
United States versus Frampton was expressly that, an unspecified favor with an inherent street value that the court conceded would have significant economic benefit, and the Second Circuit said it's not enough. This statute is a very narrow statute. I'm not saying, Judge Evans, that in that context you wouldn't have a state law prosecution for solicitation of murder, though I don't know the law in that regard. What I am saying is that you would not have a claim under Section 1958 or a prosecution, and Frampton is exactly
but,
what
but,
you're...
But in Frampton, didn't he say he would owe him a favor if the hitman killed...
Right, but what I'm saying is that is indistinguishable from I'll make it worth your while. And, in fact, the government there said, look, they offered evidence and argument and said a favor from this fellow who's so respected in the crack business in Troy, New York, that's worth a lot. That's currency in this world. That's hard cash in this world. And the Second Circuit said no. This is a very narrow statute. The best analysis of this statute, I submit the most thorough, is in Wicklund and is in Frampton. And those both hold you have to have an agreement. But I'm going into my time, but I want to say this much. I think we're right even under Hernandez, but the Hernandez case used a regular dictionary to say, well, all it means is an exchange for. This court wouldn't go that far. This court said bargain for exchange. But I guarantee you, or I would bet my bottom dollar, when Congress passed this law, they didn't mean consideration as a civilian layperson understands it. They meant consideration as we know it in contract law. That is nowhere in these instructions, and that is why Joseph Gibson was convicted, not because he's guilty. And I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Ms. Biesenthal?
May it please the Court. Bethany Biesenthal on behalf of the United States. The government submitted sufficient evidence in this case of two separate agreements to provide an item of pecuniary value. There was evidence that the defendant promised Hampton, the confidential informant in this case, 50% of the proceeds from his drug spot over which he had control and a cash payment.
Mr. O'Connor says that 3-4 days into the trial, after Hampton had been examined, that theory was pretty much abandoned.
That's not correct, Your Honor. There was sufficient evidence of both forms of pecuniary value. The first was the cash payment, and there was sufficient evidence introduced at trial of that cash payment. We have Hampton calling the defendant and asking for a few stacks, a few thousand dollars. The defendant doesn't refuse. We have Hampton's testimony that he asked for money to lay low after the commission of the murder and that the defendant said he had him. Then we have a recorded phone conversation where Hampton asks the defendant for a few hundred dollars in order to lay low after the commission of the murder, and the defendant states, right. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the verdict, when the defendant stated right, he agreed to provide Hampton with a cash payment. But that's not all that we have here. We also have the defendant's oral and written statements after he was arrested. After he was arrested, the defendant provided a written statement in which he said, Goldie, which is Hampton's nickname, asked whether Coleman was worth $3,000, and I complied. We also have the defendant's oral statement. FBI agents testified that the defendant admitted that he would have paid money for the commission of the murder of Jeffrey Coleman. He just hadn't agreed yet on the price. Then we also have sufficient evidence that the defendant agreed to provide 50% of the proceeds from his drug spot in exchange for the commission of the murder.
That's not in any of the tape recordings that were played, is it? That 50%, that just came from Hampton's.
That's correct. It came from Hampton's testimony. There is no discussion of the 50% of the drug proceeds in the recorded conversations. However, we have Hampton's testimony where he states that the defendant repeatedly promised him that 50% of the proceeds. We also have Hampton's testimony about the details of the drug spot itself. Hampton knew everything about that drug spot. He knew that the defendant had 50% control of a drug spot at Pulaski and Adams, that he shared control with Jeffrey Coleman, that when Coleman was incarcerated, he had 100% control of the drug spot. When Coleman got out of jail, the relationship went south, and the defendant was concerned that Coleman was going to kill him. Now, Hampton's testimony is directly corroborated by the defendant's statements after his arrest.
And all this evidence that you've outlined, this was all argued in closing argument, correct?
It was, Your Honor. After the defendant was arrested, he admitted that he owned or he controlled 50% of the drug spot, that his relationship with Coleman went south after Coleman got out of jail, and that he was concerned that Coleman was going to kill him. Hampton's testimony was directly corroborated by the defendant's own statements. Therefore, there was sufficient evidence that the defendant both promised a cash payment and the proceeds from the drug spot in exchange for the commission of the murder of Jeffrey Coleman. Defense counsel argued that a specific unanimity instruction was required in this case. Specific unanimity instruction was not required in this case. The jury need not unanimously agree as to the means that comprise a particular element of a particular statute so long as that means does not constitute a separate offense.
Is there a request for that made prior to?
No, Your Honor. There was no request made by the defendant or his counsel at the time of jury instructions for such an instruction. Defendant in his brief argues that he, in effect, made that request by asking for other instructions. However, even assuming that the defendant's instructions would have been given to the jury, they still would have received evidence of more than one agreement to provide something of pecuniary value. They still would have heard evidence of both the cash payment and the 50% of the drug proceeds. Now, in this case, the unit of prosecution is the use of the interstate facility. It's not the agreement. It's not the item of pecuniary value. The agreement and the item of pecuniary value do not constitute separate offenses in this case, and so the jury did not need to unanimously agree on what comprised those particular elements. Defense also argued that the cash payment in this case constituted an incidental expense, and that the district court should have provided to the jury an instruction regarding incidental expenses. However, that instruction was not warranted by the facts in this case. An incidental expense is something that is necessary in order to commit the crime. It's a requirement in order to commit that crime. A cash payment to be provided after the crime is committed is not necessary in order to carry out the crime. It's not a requirement of the crime. It's not a reimbursement for out-of-pocket losses. It's money so that the individual can live off of. It's an economic advantage to that individual. It's not incidental, and the district court rightfully rejected the defendant's proposed instruction. Now, defendant stated that Hampton himself admitted that the cash payment was not compensation or consideration for the murder. But there are two issues with that. First, Hampton is not a legal expert on what constitutes consideration or what constitutes sufficient compensation for murder. Second, what defense counsel didn't point out was that on redirect examination, Hampton stated that, in fact, both the cash payment and the 50% of the proceeds that he intended that those two items were his compensation for the murder in this case, that he expected that he would first receive the cash payment, lay low for a while, and then receive the 50% of the drug proceeds. The district court also rightfully rejected the defendant's proposed instruction that would require the jury to find an agreement, a mutual agreement, or a contract in this case. Defendant's proposed instruction was an incorrect statement of law. The murder for hire statute specifically allows three separate ways to find an agreement or an item of pecuniary value. We have receipt, promise, or agreement. It's not just agreement. And it makes sense that it's not just agreement, because this is a murder for hire context. This is not a business transaction. The individuals negotiating the terms of the murder are not sitting down to a business transaction where they expect that they will be held to an enforceable and binding contract or sign on the dotted line. It doesn't make sense. In addition, with these cases, it's often the fact that a confidential informant, like in this case, or a government agent, is the individual on the other side of the bargaining table. Those individuals certainly would not agree to a binding contract in which they actually had to carry out the commission of the crime. Now, in addition, the cases cited by the defendant...
An agent might not, but this Hampton is a pretty rotten guy.
Well, there's no doubt that Hampton has...
I don't mind saying that an agent wouldn't agree to do that, but this Hampton is... I mean, the guy's never made an honest dollar in his life except the money the FBI paid him here to be an informant.
There's no doubt that Hampton has a checkered past.
Very checkered.
Very checkered. However, it makes sense that when Gibson, the defendant, wants someone murdered, that's who he goes to.
Oh,
that's who he chooses as his assassin. That makes sense. And Hampton, in this case, he did not want to carry out the murder. He went to the FBI instead, and he told the FBI what was happening.
Hampton's in the... Unknown Vice Lord Street Gang? What is that one? I've never heard of that one.
The Unknown Vice Lords?
I've heard of the Vice Lords, but not the Unknown Vice Lords.
I don't know very much about the Unknown Vice Lords myself. I'm not sure the difference between the two. The cases cited by the defendant for the proposition, which he states, say that the contract or mutual agreement is required under the statute. Those cases do not state that. The cases do state that the murder-for-hire statute contemplates a quid pro quo-type relationship, but those cases specifically state it's a quid pro quo-type relationship or the promise of such. And that language is key here. There need not be a mutual agreement. A promise is sufficient. If there are no further questions from the panel, the government requests that this court affirm the defendant's conviction on all four counts.
I guess I would like you to address that Frampton case, that Second Circuit case.
Certainly. In Frampton, the defendant offered the individual who he wanted to commit the murder an unspecified future favor. There was absolutely no indication what that future favor would be. There was certainly no indication that that future favor would be something like a cash payment in this case, which has been held to be sufficient and which under the statute is expressly sufficient. And it certainly was no indication that the future favor would be the proceeds from future crimes, profits from future crimes, which in the Richardson case was specifically held to be sufficient as well. Thank you.
4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly, I'd like to step back and begin at the beginning, which is with respect to the theory about 50% of the proceeds from the drug spot. Walter Hampton took the witness stand, and he testified that he literally spoke to Mr. Gibson once every 4 days for 5 months. And in every single conversation, they talked about two things. This is his testimony, the fact that Gibson wanted him to kill Hampton, and then he would get half the proceeds. He said they talked about it on the phone, they talked about it in person. Somehow, that's not in the tapes. And that's why I submit to you at the end of the trial, the theory wasn't abandoned, but it was downgraded. It became just one theory in the spread offense. To step back from that, when you're Mr. Gibson and you've got a half dozen alleged agreements, now at the end of the trial, the government is claiming against you. It's terribly important with a statute that is so limited like this that the jury be properly instructed. And let me go through each of the agreements and explain where our instruction would have stepped in to give Mr. Gibson a fair hearing. Taking the first thing Ms. Biesenthal talked about, Mr. Gibson never said, "I got you." You can look at the transcript of the tape when Mr. Hampton said, "Can I have 3 stacks in a recorded conversation to get out of town?" Mr. Gibson said, "What you need that for? Let's talk." Look at the final conversation. Ms. Biesenthal and the government are saying because Mr. Gibson merely said the word "right" in a long passage, interjecting as a punctuation in the middle of what Mr. Hampton said, that somehow he agreed by that to pay $200 or a couple hundred dollars to let him get out of town. Even though in the rest of the conversation he says you don't need to get out of town. Just look at that, which the government relied on extensively to argue for conviction. Is that an unspecified expectation at best? I would say yes. No one would say, walking out, "Well, he said right at one point, but he did tell me I didn't want to leave town." The jury needed to understand and have the tools to understand that's not a sufficient promise. That's more like Frampton. And second, it's incidental expenses. And on that point, I do want to say this to the court, which I think is critically important. What the government said on the incidental expenses point is a jury argument. Once Hampton said it's an expense, not compensation, we get an instruction. Hampton didn't say this was something for him. If you read the last interchange the government relies on, Hampton says this is necessary to protect Gibson. So it's clearly an expense. And the government at pages 426 and 427 is flat wrong when it says Hampton was rehabilitated. Hampton still says expense. But my point is, it doesn't matter. At that point, we're entitled to an instruction. In this case, with 6 different agreements out there, all of them terribly vague, none of them, in our view, sufficiently supported, and you've got this statute that says, in consideration for a promise or agreement to pay, which the courts have said, this court said, requires a bargain for exchange, you needed instructions that taught the jury how to sort through these. and determine whether they're sufficient or not. And I submit that also required them to come to unanimity, and that didn't happen here. The jury was told basically in relation to. That's the way it read. And I just want to say on unanimity, it's letting the tail wag the dog. I just would end on this. The gravamen of the offense is the agreement, and that jury almost certainly didn't agree as to what Gibson did in that regard. And to me, if that's at a minimum plain error with a very substantial right. Thank you.
All right, the case will be taken under advisement.